Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Awesome mad fellow he was. Who did you think it was?
Nay, I know not.
A pestilence on him for a mad rogue. He poured a flagon of Rhenish on my head once. This skull, sir, was Sir Yorick's skull. The king's jester.
This?
He and that.
Let me see. Alas. Poor Yorick.
I knew him, Horatio. A fellow of infinite jest. Of most excellent fancy. He hath borne me on his back 1,000 times. And now, how abhorred in my imagination it is. My gorge rises at it. Here hung those lips that I have kissed. I know not how oft. Where be your gibes now? Your gambols, your songs, your flashes of merriment that were wont to set the table on a roar. Not one now to mock your own grinning.
Welcome to The Play's the Thing. That was David Tennant in the title role of Hamlet, speaking to the skull of Yorick, the jester of Hamlet's father. I am here, as always, with my two favorite Hamlet commentators, and they are...
I'm Heidi White.
I'm Andrew Kern.
You guys, we've made it to Act 5 of Hamlet. Mm-hmm. Something tells me it's not going to end without a body count. That's just my feeling.
It's Am either that or a wedding. And I think that ship has sailed.
It's either that or a wedding. You're exactly right, Heidi. It's either that or a wedding. Shakespeare is so predictable.
Could be a dance. Much Ado About Nothing doesn't end with a wedding.
No, Much Ado ends with two weddings. Two weddings.
And they a dance.
Well, there's the wedding, and then there's... Then there's Benedict says, I want to get married too. And then they have the argument about should we wait till after or before? And they dance before the wedding.
But come on, that's a technicality, right? Yeah, it is with harmony. You're like, come on, that's a quibble.
Yeah, it ends with harmony, certainly.
That's Jesuitical. So that's Jesuitical.
That is
saying that it doesn't end with a wedding. Your reasoning is Jesuitical.
That word before. That's so.
You don't
great.
Know that word? Like
I do now. Yep.
Overly given to parsing and
hyperscholastic. So I would.
Yeah, hyperscholastic and a little bit sneaky.
My dad used to say, Andrew, you're so pernickety, and I'd say, Dad, the word's persnickety. But the thing is. Okay, it's Shakespeare. If he has them dance before they get married, there's a reason. it's not just Jesuitical. It's there's a reason. And so,
all right, well, let's save it for the Much Ado podcast.
Hamlet, however, yep, that doesn't end with wedding or dance.
It's definitely death. Yes. Death permeates this entire act.
Yep. The act begins with Hamlet's return from England. And as he's returning to the castle, he kind of happens upon these two gravediggers. The two gravediggers, we find out, are, I mean, this, let's just imagine this. You stumble upon two gravediggers, and who are they digging the grave for? We discover for Ophelia, for poor Ophelia, who has drowned. Hamlet hasn't seen her, of course, since he left. Presumably there's been no contact, and that he left her under extremely tortured circumstances, I think in love with her. The rest of the act is very, gets immediately to the point. There's a proposed fencing duel between the brother of Ophelia, Laertes. He's been commissioned by the king to finally do Hamlet in. And so he has a poison-tipped foil that he is going to use in this fight with Hamlet. And all he needs to do is nick him, and the job is done. So that's where we're headed. That's the great climactic finale of Hamlet. But I want to start with this scene. Alas, poor Yorick. I knew him well, Horatio, a fellow of infinite jest. This is one of those scenes that is almost, for me, it has like kind of a silhouette that presents itself in my mind with Hamlet holding the skull of Yorick. And it's an unforgettable scene. For me, and I want to hear you guys like reflect on this. For me, it's this juxtaposition between between Yorick as the jester, the man of a thousand jibes, who was employed to make the court laugh, who apparently loved Hamlet, would dawdle Hamlet on his knee, and to be introduced to him decades after his death, when the last time that Hamlet saw him, he saw him, his lips would kiss Hamlet, he would tease Hamlet, he would make jokes with Hamlet, and now Hamlet, it sees him as a worm-cleaned skull. And that juxtaposition for me between the frivolity of who he used to be and now staring at kind of like the vacant-eyed skull of Yorick is just a masterpiece of stagecraft. Does this scene really affect you guys when you see, read, hear Hamlet? Is this one of those scenes for you guys?
Certainly. When I was a boy, I grew up in Milwaukee, and there's a museum on the lakefront in Milwaukee that has a great big, as I recall, life-size painting of a monk holding a skull. And I didn't know anything about, you know, monastic disciplines or anything when I saw that. But immediately, even as, what, maybe 14, 15 years old, as soon as I saw that, I just wanted to stand there and stare at that painting. I didn't know there's this thing called memento mori, right? It's a spiritual discipline where you hold a skull in your hand and you contemplate death. Mm. I didn't know that that's what that was. In fact, I probably thought it was something out of, well, Harry Potter hadn't come out yet, but I would have thought that it was something out of Harry Potter, yeah, right? That's how narrow, well, my mind was. So that was my first encounter with somebody holding a skull and contemplating.
And Andrew, it wasn't a painting of Hamlet. It was kind of a painting of
a monk.
Okay. Okay.
Yes, of a monk. And if you go online and look up Memento Mori, it'll probably come up. It's a fairly famous painting, I have learned since then. That was my first encounter of a person holding a skull and thinking about death. Mm. So when then I saw Hamlet, which I encountered first as a movie, And I saw Hamlet holding the skull of Yorick. Mm. That immediately, you know, that was my background to it.
That connected, yeah.
Uh-huh. And a few things come out about that. One is that I was drawn to that just because it was there. There's something so primal about that direct gazing on, let's say, death, the direct reflection on death. It's not something we do a lot of. And secondly, when I think about it, I don't know that that monk knew whose skull he was holding. And that's pretty significant. It may have been that it was the skull of a former mentor or something. But the picture doesn't indicate one way or another. And I don't know if what the tradition would require. But Hamlet does. And so not only is he contemplating death in the abstract, let's call it, but he's contemplating the death of a person that he knew and loved. Mm-hmm. And all of us have to do that at some point. But not many of us do that at the grave of the person that we knew and loved, mm-hmm. and then hold that person's skull in our hands. And there is something unbelievably provocative in some sense, something you can't. Okay. I think when people see this scene, when I encounter this scene, one of two things will happen to me. One is, I won't want to get absorbed in it and I'll just keep going and, you know, not let it affect me because I got to get a grade or something. The other is it'll stop me. Right. And then you start thinking deeper and deeper about Hamlet and what Hamlet is saying about death and about death itself. And Shakespeare through Hamlet brilliantly kind of draws everybody into doing the spiritual discipline of contemplating death. And it's entirely up to us how far we go with it. So that's how right now it affects me. But honestly, it affects me differently every time.
Every time. Yeah. I think that's really important. And I think this particular time I was moved for Hamlet in the sense that this is a play that is like death permeates the entire thing. Like it's woven into the fabric of the play that death in the future, death in the past, like Hamlet's father's death that has already happened, the death of Claudius that Hamlet is like, is his doom, right? And is his fate to cause the death of another human being. And then Ophelia's death. And I think that is particularly poignant that we know there's this dramatic irony happening in this scene that we know Ophelia is dead and that's whose grave they're digging. And yet Hamlet doesn't know. And so he's so moved by the death of this man he knew as a child. How's he going to react then, we wonder as the audience, when he knows that the grave that's being dug, and he's just had these like sparring words with the clown. How's he going to know that? How's he going to react when he finds out that this is his love and that he's contributed to her death? Right.
Yeah.
And that death, and we're in act five. So another thing is the audience we know is that death is coming for Hamlet soon. He's going to be the guy whose lips are falling off his skull. Right. And so there's all of this kind of universal contemplation of death. You brought up the spiritual practice of memento mori. I remember death. And also there's within the play, there's this kind of hanging sense of doom that has been coming throughout the play and is now about to happen. We are about to see kind of this like dark flower of death, come to fruition for Hamlet and for everybody around him. And he's holding a skull in his hand, thinking about death. Mm-hmm. It's such a powerful scene on the universal level and on the personal level.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you just triggered a thought in my mind. I got to ask a question. Remember the play that Hamlet puts on at the beginning of it? There's a dumb act,
like a preface. Yeah, right.
Okay. And that dumb show then is played out in the rest of the play, right? And even the dumb show is preceded by a little statement that says, "Here's the story," and then Hamlet says, "Is this the preface or the posy of a ring?" Right? Like that was so short. Is that what Shakespeare's doing now? is he's giving us a dumb show of the rest of Act Five.
Oh, that's good. I like that. I've always thought that this whole scene this whole act has this kind of like smaller microcosm of drama that is weightier than even the rest of the play, which isn't light. You know what I mean? Like Act right. Five is so intense. As you just said, Andrew, you can go as far as you want into it as the audience. If it's too much for you, you can kind of pull out. And he gives us some moments of comedy, even within, like, I think the best comedy the in beginning the whole of play scene. Is in this act.
Absolutely.
Like the Osric comedy, the clown comedy. Like, so you can kind of pull out if you want to, but even in the comedy, there's such depth of insight, like the conversation between the clowns about which is, you know, who's the best builder and which is the safest houses, right? It's the house of death. And that's, you know, the punchline of the joke, but also like maybe the punchline of the joke of human life, ? Right. So there's just such intensity within this scene. What about you, Tim? What do you make of that Yorick scene?
I just want to comment about the playful interchange between the grave diggers. There's just this really, really funny scene. These two guys are digging, you know, the first grave digger. There's no ancient gentlemen, but gardeners, ditchers, and grave makers. They hold up Adam's profession. Other. Was he a gentleman? He was the first that ever bore arms. Why, he had none. Why, art thou a heathen? How dost thou understand the scriptures? The scripture says that Adam digged. Could he dig without arms? This is all making a joke that because he had arms, thus he was a gentleman because he like had a coat of arms. It's really clever stuff. By the way, parents, if you ever have a couple of kids that you want to introduce to a Shakespeare scene, I think the interplay between the grave diggers, especially if the kids can understand what they're saying, the kind of humor, that's a great one to start with just over the dinner table. That'd be a fun one to kind of rehearse and play. Yeah. The Yorick scene is one of my favorites in the whole canon. And the universality of death is so powerful. I mean, in Hamlet's sitting with his skull, he thinks first about missing his friend, you know, the jester, Yorick, the man he knew. And then he goes in this long discourse about, wait, this could have been a lawyer. And if he was a lawyer, he would have lived this sort of life. Why, this might have been a businessman. And if he was a businessman, he might have sold this sort of property and that sort of property. And he kind of cast this wide net around kind of like all of the potential professions that this person could have been. He happened to be a jester. And you're caught in that net. You're swept up in that net and you can't help. It reminds me so much of the very middle of the play, To Be or Not to Be, the discourse on all of the reasons why we would want to leave life because of all of the harms, the law's delay, the pangs of despised love. All of these things are kind of temptations for us to leave death. And yet we don't leave death because of this worry about what's beyond the grave, the undiscovered country. I just think that this scene is playing that theme with such expertise and tenderness, surrounded by great humor at the front end, surrounded by incredible pathos at the back end, discovering this is Ophelia's grave, you know? And in her grave, we are going to discover that we have another enemy that we have to face, Laertes, the angry brother of Ophelia, the son of the deceased, killed by Hamlet, Polonius. You know, we're thrust. It's just remarkable. It accomplishes so much in, you know, 7 thrifty pages. It's just stunning to me. Every time I encounter this scene, I'm just stunned by it. I want to talk about Ophelia. Do we know for sure now at the grave of Ophelia that Hamlet truly did love her. She was not merely a plaything. Or is that after this scene, is that still a question for us? Heidi?
I just find this question so fascinating. It's as we've talked about so many times on this podcast and in offline conversations about Hamlet, this is one of the greatest works of literature in the history of the world. And it seems relatively straightforward when you first encounter it, and then you start thinking about it. And this is one of those questions that I find endlessly mysterious. Did Hamlet really love Ophelia? His response to her death is so strong. He doesn't know she's dead. And so at her grave, he jumps in and he wrestles with her brother, and he claims 40,000 brothers could not love her as I loved her. And it's so moving. And he's just had this contemplation of death. And there's just this like uniting in the grave of the over this like primal wrestling between jealous men. It's just such a powerful image over the body of this woman. And yet, man, Hamlet was so unkind and callous towards her in life in this play. And, or was he, right? And just so their relationship is just so complex, and his response to her death seems simple. But when you start thinking about it, I'm not so sure. I'm not satisfied because he expresses no remorse. No sense, like there's no statement of repentance that comes from Hamlet. I was a party to this. I was like, he doesn't ask any questions about himself and his role in her life. He just claims that he loves her and wrestles with Laertes and apologizes for it later. Like I am not convinced that Hamlet bears the full weight of his responsibility toward Ophelia. I think he feels sincere grief. That's not a question, because that was a spontaneous response. Like he feels grief.
Right.
Whether or not that grief comes from, let me say it this way. The nature of their relationship and the interactions between them in the play leads me to believe that a statement of true love from Hamlet would require some repentance from him, and I don't see it.
In the moment, in the emotions of the moment, I say I totally understand this response. It's hard for me to imagine Hamlet, as introspective as he is, having the ability both to recognize, oh my goodness, I've just seen Yorick, I just lost Ophelia, and I think he loved her. Mm-hmm. And to be able to kind of also in the same moment recognize that he had a hand in his death, that seems even too much for Hamlet in this moment. 20 minutes later, walking home with Horatio, maybe, but our camera's kind of off him at that point.
Yeah.
Does it make sense, Heidi?
Absolutely. I don't quibble necessarily over that. And I do believe that he loved her. I wish that there would have been a moment of like, God have mercy on me for what happened to this woman.
Yeah, right. Because no doubt he bore a huge responsibility in it. This is,
But I don't know, Andrew, thoughts on this?
As we're talking about this right now, I left a reading that the team is doing here of a book that's coming out very soon called Good in Everything, Meditations on Shakespeare, by Josh Mayle, and that'll be released around not long after this recording is up. So people might be interested. The reason I mention is because he has a chapter in that book on Henry V, in which he compares Henry V to a duck rabbit. And the idea is that if you look at Henry V as a duck, you'll see a duck. And if you look as a rabbit, you'll see a rabbit, but you can't see both at the same time.
Can I say a little bit more about that, Andrew? Just that there's a line drawing that was made. It was kind of made popular by a philosopher named Wittgenstein. It's a line drawing that's very, very simple. And it really is, if you say, look at it, it's a duck, you'll see a duck. And if you say to yourself, look at it, it's a rabbit,
you just have to change the orientation. So if it's horizontal, it's a rabbit. If it's vertical, it's a duck. And so as Andrew's saying, you can't see.
No, I don't even think you need to do that. I just think it's like, it's what your mind kind of presupposes you to look for. Anyway, why am I taking us all off track? Anyway, why am I taking this on a rabbit and duck trail?
Because whether it's perspective or expectation, when you read Henry V, you see what you expect to see. And my contention would be that that's also the same with Hamlet, that you can't see both at the same time. If there's two, there's 28 Hamlets, but you can't see all of them at the same time. So when you read it, you see what you're ready to see on that read. And that's why it requires multiple reads. Like in the old days, you have slides, remember, that overheads, and you'd lay one transparency on top of another to reveal more and more textuality. One of the things that might be worth mentioning is Hamlet's words. Was it when he was about to torment Gertrude, or was it, I forget who said it, but it's the old cruel to be kind. Basically, I must be cruel, but only to be kind. I forget his exact wording, but it became a pop song in the '80s. Well, what if that's entirely what he's had to do with Ophelia's? He had to be cruel in the circumstances in order to be kind to her. If that's what you're expecting to see, that's what you'll see. And if you're expecting to see he's just a jerk, he's cruel, you got all the evidence in the world for that. And so when I think of Hamlet's response to Ophelia, does Hamlet love her? It's hard to imagine he doesn't in some way love her, intensely even. And is he also cruel to her? It's hard to argue that he's not cruel to her. And then it becomes but was it okay to be cruel to her? And then it becomes, well, what's his role in society? And then just climbs up this, as he kind of plays with it, there becomes this heap that you climb up, this mountain that you climb up. And maybe that mountain that you have to climb up to understand Hamlet is precisely the mountain that buries him under itself in his appeal when he says, let the mountains be buried. You and me, Laertes, let's be buried under these mountains, right? Maybe that's an echo of that. There's just the weight of reality, and Hamlet can't bear it any more than anybody else can. And so he cracks. And because he cracks, we have all these different Hamlets, right? Because he's cracked. But that's why we used to say to people when we meant they were crazy, we'd say, you're cracked, right? So, but there's one last thought that I want to add here, which is that there is reason to believe that in Act 5, we have the most whole, is that the word? Hamlet, the most whole Hamlet, that when he went to England, he had this experience. It was like going to hell, and now he's coming back to the land of the living. He's gone through death. But if that's the case, then why, when he's gone through death and gets back to Denmark, does he go to a grave, right? Is this a symbol of resurrection or a hint of what's coming? He does later on seem very much resigned to what's coming. He seems fuller, but I don't know.
I think that's a great question.
I'm going to play a little audio of a conversation after we leave Ophelia's grave and we're getting ready for the fencing scene, the climactic scene of the entire play. Hamlet and his best friend Horatio kind of steal away, and Hamlet is recounting what happened to him and what he did while he's on the ship to England. Let's play this audio. This will be David Tennant again in the role of Hamlet.
There's a divinity that shapes our ends. Rough hew them how we will.
That is most certain. So, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead.
My man, they did make love to this employment. They are not near my conscience.
Why, what a king is this?
Does it not, thinks thee, stand me now upon? He that hath killed my king and whored my mother, popped in between the election and my hopes, thrown out his angle for my proper life, and with such cousinage. It's not perfect conscience to quit him with this arm. But I am very sorry, good Horatio, that to Laertes I forgot myself.
when our deep plots do pall, and that should teach us there's a divinity that shapes our ends, rough hew them how we will. This, coming from Hamlet, to me is a signal that something has really changed. Andrew, you referred to this right before we heard that audio. Something has changed when he's been gone. The question for me is it a world weariness that he's now accepted, like a callousness? Or is there a peace, like a genuine soul deep peace that he has arrived at before he goes in to basically face his death? And I think he knows it. Do you lean? I'm going to ask you this first, Heidi, and then I'm going to come to you, Andrew. How do you read Hamlet at this part of the play? Is it callousness? Is it some sort of peacefulness that there is a divine will that shapes our ends?
Yeah, this may be the hardest question of Hamlet for me to answer. And with any kind of sincerity, I am completely 100% on the fence on this. And I think that, to go back to the rabbit duck picture, which you're right, you don't need to change the orientation. I was remembering it wrong. I think that, you know, one of the accusations that's often leveled against Shakespeare is that he's an equivocator, right? Like, he doesn't take a stand. He presents one side and then the other, and nobody knows where he stands on political issues or faith or whatever. I think that's a sign of his greatness. I do not believe that he's an equivocator at all. I just think he is aware of the mystery of being human and writes that into his plays so brilliantly, and most brilliantly of all in Hamlet. Because I think with Henry V, and I don't want to take the conversation off, but Josh Mayo's point in Henry V is valid, right? Like, you can either look at Henry, Prince Hal, having become a king as it was kind of a manipulative ploy, and that he was playing the system, and that he is, you know, just like his father. Or you can look at the other way, that he's a sincere desiring to be a Christian king, right? The mirror of all Christian kings. But the truth is that however you stand, he's either one or the other. It's different with Hamlet. With Hamlet, he's not a rabbit or a duck. He's like a rabbit duck, like a drabbit. So that's, I look at this question of where does Hamlet stand at the end? Is he in peace of soul, or is he in just this despair and callousness? And I don't think it's one or the other. I think it's a drabbit. So
can I say this back to you, Heidi, yes, to see if I understand? Because I think this is really insightful. If you're staging Henry V and you're the director, or you're the actor playing,
you kind of have to pick a lane.
Yes, you have to pick a lane. And we could probably say the same thing about maybe Richard II. We said, we're talking about Henry V. We could also, make the same sort of decision about
with many, many, especially in the history plays, with many of the characters, you have to pick a lane. It's either the actor is either going to have to be a rabbit or a duck.
Yeah.
And that's with Hamlet. Yes. Anyway, keep going.
So
you're trying to say my words back at me, and I'm just trying to say them again. That's rude.
What I hear you saying is the lane you kind of have to pick if you're going to direct or play Hamlet is you have to pick the middle lane. You have to embrace both of these aspects of Hamlet. And it would be a poor choice to just say, no, he's this great titanic existential hero who makes all the right choices.
It would also be the wrong lane to say. To come along. Right.
Yeah. It was inevitable. It was only a matter of time. Or he is this kind of like broken, corrupted, you know, maligned and maligning figure who does more harm than good. To just play one role or the other role would be to say duck or rabbit. You have to kind of like embrace both of these things.
But what's interesting, I mean, I'm not an actress, you're an actor. So I would really be curious, but So despair and peace are opposites. They cannot coexist, right? And meaning, well, that's not my point. This is complicated. They can coexist in the same soul, but they are opposites. But if you're watching it play out from the outside, despair and peace might look the same, right? It might look like resignation to fate, which is what we have in Hamlet here in this scene. He's going to go into this fight. He has a sense that he's going to die and he does it anyway. He fulfills his purpose. He kills Claudius, right? And so happy ending, exclamation point.
Right.
But that's too simple. That's not what we have in this scene. Like there's this vacillation in his soul that we see. Like he doesn't express repentance over Ophelia's death. And we can't tell whether his apology to Laertes is sincere. He claims, "I only killed your dad out of madness," but the whole time he says that he wasn't really mad, right? Mm-hmm. So there is this equivocation, and the word is even used in this scene. So, like you said, you can interpret Hamlet as just kind of this despairing, whatever, I don't even care anymore. I'm just going to go to my death, like making claims along the way and missing out on opportunities to make things right. Right. But he says there's a divinity that shapes our ends. And then he actually does fulfill his purpose. And it's complicated. And that's all I'm going to say. I'm going to want to hear from the two of you.
Andrew, I'm going to slightly change the question that I gave to Heidi and maybe make it even harder. If you had to predict Hamlet's trajectory, let's imagine that he's not killed in Act 5. Based on what we see previous to the fencing match, what's his trajectory? Is it toward maybe despair, callousness? Is it toward an acceptance of the divine ends? Would you be willing to make a wager on that?
If
he survives the fencing match, what do you think his trajectory would be?
Well, this is why Fortinbras is so important to this play.
Oh, gosh. If you didn't listen to Act 4, now you need to rewind and like listen to us haggle about
it. That was amazing. Thank you for that.
Because Fortinbras has an opinion, and I'm inclined tentatively to agree with him. He is like to have proved most was it royal. I think that Hamlet, being the son of Hamlet, and being through what he's been through, if he came out of this experience alive and being the king, he would certainly have had control over the court. He would have, every opponent would have been removed. And given all the things that he's had to process, the hell that he's been through, the Hades and back, the resurrection he's encountered, because you remember, he was supposed to be beheaded. The king did send him to England to be beheaded with a message saying, behead this guy. But he conquered death. So given all of that, if he doesn't suffer a complete breakdown, I think he would probably be a good king. But why are you asking that question? Is it because you don't want my opinion about the other one?
About the other one? What do you mean the other one?
The earlier question about peace and resignation. And
No. I would like that. To me, asking about his trajectory is another way of asking that same question. It's sort of like we don't get to see it play out with Hamlet, peace or callousness.
Yeah.
I'm kind of asking a predictive question.
So in order to think about that, you're saying, okay. So I think that one of the things that's become data driven, or how do you say it? It's become demonstrable through data, is that people with a religious foundation handle stress better. Mm. And people who believe in something endure disappointment and trial better, generally speaking, than people who don't. And therefore, the crucial question becomes, as it was put. Has Hamlet reached some kind of neutral, despairing resignation, or has he reached some kind of Zen state of acceptance, or faith? Has he become a man of faith? And I don't know, again, but I noted a couple things while you guys were chatting and I was listening, but also skimming. He does all of a sudden start talking to it. Well, I don't know if he did this earlier in the play. So what I notice in Act 5 is that he does talk about the line that you got brought up, that there's a divinity that shapes our ends. Okay. And also in line 80, heaven was ordinant, line 54, even in that was heaven ordinant, heaven ordered things.
Yeah. Right?
In Act 5, scene 1, he's reflecting on death, he does seem to be doing it in light of the existence of a deity and in light of another transcendent realm. Whereas he talks about Alexander and he talks about Yorick pushing his materialism, let's say, or pushing his naturalism, pushing that cynical assumption about existence all the way to its very edge. When he says, to what base uses we may return Horatio, right? He says we, but he's referring to our body. So it's utterly reductionistic. Why may not imagination trace the noble dust of Alexander till he find it stopping a bunghole, which is, you know, a hole in a beer barrel, something like that. And Horatio's response is, 'twere to consider too curiously to consider it so. And in the most ironic two words in the book, maybe, Hamlet says,
no
faith. and then proceeds to think about it in materialistic terms, right? But by the end, he's at least opened up the possibility that there's another way to think about this, right? And if you come to hold a skull in your hand to contemplate death and you have the guts to do that for an extended period of time, and you conclude that the only significance of this is that Alexander the Great might well have become a cork, right? Then that's despair. And that might lead you to resignation. And if you accept that completely, I don't know if you can, but if you accept that completely, then you might enter into a sort of a Zen state, right? But if you break through that, and your soul is brought into the perception of the eternal, okay, then that's a completely different matter. And does Hamlet go one way or the other? I like to think that Hamlet attains faith. Mm-hmm. I like to think that he's serious what he says to Horatio about, you know, the readiness is all.
Yeah.
I like to think that's what he's coming.
I like to think so too. And maybe this point of the play is where that decision is actually like being formulated in him, you know, maybe Act 5 is where it's all like we're catching him kind of in the scene where, Claudius is praying and he's asking for mercy. And after that, he shifts from sort of like dark to demonic, you know,
beautiful.
Like maybe this is where we are with Hamlet. This is like the moment of decision. And I want him to choose the life of faith. I kind of think he does. If I had to bet on his trajectory, I kind of think he does.
Well, that's why it becomes a comic ending, So the very first line in Act 5, for first two lines, I wonder, this might sound irrelevant, but it's not. I don't think it is. Is when the gravedigger, the clown, says to the other clown, is she to be buried in Christian burial when she willfully seeks her own salvation? Mm-hmm. I mean, you talk about ironic, willfully seeking
her own salvation. Like, what a great line. What an absolutely great line, yeah.
So here's my question. How does Ophelia willfully seeking her own salvation, or not, because we don't know,
right,
but how does that line juxtapose, that's the word, Tim, you've used a few times, which is a cool word. How does that line juxtapose with Claudius's prayer and Hamlet's not killing Claudius? And then to make it more complicated still, how does it also compare with Hamlet going all the way through to being willing to die himself, thus willfully seeking his own salvation in the duel?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. I think that that's a really just an incredible question. Shakespeare seems to go to great lengths in this play, and particularly in Act Five, to remind us of the sacramental structure of death, that there are, that there is this kind of framework of sacramental reality that ushers souls into the afterlife. For example, Ophelia having committed suicide, maybe, question mark, right? There are people who think it was an accident, right? But it's not told, but it is strongly implied that it was suicide. In that case, then, she shouldn't have a Christian burial, and that would be an obstacle to her entry into the kingdom of God. And that would be something that had to be overcome in the afterlife. That's also true with Claudius. Like, we're reminded of that sacramental structure of the reality of death with Claudius when he's praying in the chapel. We are again reminded of it through a couple in the final scene with all the death happening, right? And we're even reminded of it in Act Five when he's talking about Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. He says specifically that the letter tells them to not to kill them immediately so that they are unshrived, so they are unable to make a final confession, right? And so it would have been understood to an Elizabethan audience what's at stake here. For modern Christians, we kind of lose that or see it as superstitious or tangential to the conversation in Hamlet, but it's not tangential. It's embedded within the conversation. Are these souls going to get to go to heaven after they die? Death is not just death, right? There is a sacramental structure that guides and guards the transition of the soul from life to death. And so in violating those rules, so to speak, that sacramental structure, there are consequences, not just in this life, but in the life to come. And Hamlet is very aware of that and takes it into consideration. And we as the audience ought to, I think, enter into that. Even if we don't see that as even modern Christians who kind of have stripped that sacrament from death, that sacramental framework, I think in order to understand the true pathos of the story, we have to put a little bit of time and effort into accepting the terms of that within the play. Mm. That it does indeed matter that Ophelia has committed suicide. And what Hamlet is grieving at her death is not just her loss, but the fact that that in her death, she may have eternal consequences in the manner in which she died.
Right.
And that is important to the story.
Yeah.
Definitely important here in this act. And Shakespeare seems to go to great lengths to remind his audience, like, pay attention. This is not just about becoming a bunghole, right? Like, there's the soul and its transition into death there's something at stake in how people die.
I want to transition us into the final scene. I've got a couple of questions. I want to know what you guys think about Gertrude's decision to drink the poison. So, and then I would like some closing thoughts about Hamlet's final words. I do want to tell a little story. I just want to, Hamlet, I played Hamlet. We've talked about it a little bit on the podcast. The role is so grueling. I cannot tell you how grueling it was. And I was just remembering this transition between Ophelia's graveside and the fencing scene. I would come on stage and it's, you know, a 3-hour production and I would be so exhausted and I had to kind of explicate what happened on this boat coming back from England, what Hamlet did and you know, what happened to Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. And it's just exposition to Horatio. And I know that on the other side of this exposition is, I've got to go to war with a sword in my hand. The guy who was playing Laertes in our production was special forces. He was trained in special forces. He was an absolute athlete, like highest order. And I had been training physically to play this role, like really hard for 3 months. I think I lost 20 pounds. I was like slim and I was, you know, strong. Cause I mean, I had to be. Okay. The interlude. Opening night, we did the fencing scene, and there's a scene in which Hamlet kind of gets tripped. It's part of the choreography. I get tripped and I fall, and I'm supposed to kind of roll out of it. I don't roll out of it, and I land right on the point of my hip. Right on the point of my hip on that hard stage. But I don't think anything about it aside from, oh, that's smarted. And then we get up and we finish the scene. Next day, my parents fly in town because they want to see me perform Hamlet. I go pick them up at the airport. Number one, I cannot speak because I used my voice so poorly on opening night. I was so nervous to get through the play and get all the lines out that I was like, my register was way up in my throat. I wasn't breathing from my belly. Like what I always teach my students, I failed in everything that I taught them. So I was way up in my throat and I show up, pick up mom and dad at the airport, and we go to a Subway restaurant, and I say, Mom, you've got to order for me because you know what I like. And she's like, how are you going to play Hamlet tonight? I was like, I don't know, but I'm going to. I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I'm going to do it. And I'm limping the whole time, and the fall swelled into this. I cannot tell you how horrific it looked. It was like half a softball on my right hip. And it throughout the performance, you know, during the following weeks that we had performed this play, all of the bruising would kind of like fell down my right leg. And my right leg for probably half the performance was like green and black. It was incredible. And I had to fall on it every single night. I just want to shout out to like all the people that have played Hamlet know, like, it's so grueling. It's not getting up and like saying some lines. It just demands everything. Yeah. We get to the final fencing scene and we know it's going down. We know that the daggers are poisoned. One of the daggers is poison tipped. We know that there is poison in one of the chalices. It's everything is primed for court to fall. In the scene, Gertrude drinks from the poison chalice. And there's a question, I think, about whether or not she knows what she's doing. And I want to know if you guys have an opinion about this. Because it really, I think, is going to shape what we think about Gertrude at the end of our play. Is this an accident? She doesn't realize what's going on? Or maybe when she does realize it, it's kind of too late? Or is this a willful decision to end her own life? Yeah, to seek her own salvation, a la Ophelia. Andrew, do you have a conviction about this?
Never thought about that question before, so now I'm going to respond naively. But I'll say this, that if she did it on purpose, it's because of two things. One is, potentially, she was so angry at Claudius when she discovered the truth about him or admitted the truth, accepted the truth about him. She was so angry that she wanted to hurt him, and that was a way to do it. The second thing is, she was so guilty about her involvement that she wanted to be punished. And so for those reasons, I could imagine her doing it. But I've never before, I didn't know that was a question. So that's interesting. I never thought of it. It's a compelling question, but I've always just seen her as sort of a victim.
Yeah.
Well, I've never thought about it in terms of whether she knew that the cup was poisoned either. I assumed that she didn't. And I agree with Andrew for if she was, I mean, to me, it's a really interesting question though, because if she did know and decided to drink, she's, then we have the question of whether that was a courageous act or a cowardly act, right? Like, we have another should question. Should she have done that? Especially considering all the things that we just talked about death and the sacramental structure. It would be then a suicide, and she'd be risking her immortal soul, and she would die in her sins as her husband did, right? And there's that, so that makes it more interesting. But it would also be maybe, as Andrew just said, because she is so highlighted in the play as a victim, it might be her only way out then,
right,
ever to be like her only act of personal agency in the play is in this moment, whether or not it's because she's committing suicide, or the other option is that she doesn't know that the cup is poisoned, but it actually is the only time she ever defies Claudius overtly within the play. Andrew, you made the point at the beginning of Act Four that there might have been a turning point, and maybe from that moment on, she's kind of like a double agent, right? Like, she might then, in a sense, be trying to help Hamlet by kind of flying under the radar with Claudius. But this is her only act of overt disobedience and rebellion towards a man in the play. And it's Claudius. Yeah. So this is her moment of agency. And what does it do? It leads to her death. Is that irony, or is that freedom, right? Is Shakespeare setting her free, or is she paying yet another consequence of her actions? And is this justice, or is it both, right? Is it a rabbit or a duck, or is it both, right? Is it a rabbit? It's a complicated moment, but it is, you know, every time she says, "No, my lord, I will," I'm always like, "You go, girl, like you don't," but oh, well, you're about to die. So is this a defiance that is punished, or is it an act of the will that leads to her freedom in the only way she ever could possibly be free?
I have seen actresses play Gertrude as defiant, like drinking a toast to Claudius.
Yeah, like middle finger
exactly,
up.
Exactly, right,
drink this
right.
Cup, get off my back, right?
Part of me finds that so satisfying. I mean, I kind of like check the sort of like salvific ramifications of this and just think about it as sort of a statement against the great devil of the play, who is Claudius. It's really satisfying when it's played by that. Again, the salvific aspect of it is troubling, but in that moment, you can kind of see.
Can I comment on that?
Please, yeah.
So Heidi just spent some time expressing the importance of the sacramental view of death and all the implications of that. And when you just use the term salvific, forgive me, but all of a sudden that first line in Act Five, which I never really thought very hard about, is starting to weigh down on me again. Is she to be buried?
What's
in
that line?
What? When she willfully seeks her own salvation, is the whole thing that's going on in the play Hamlet a bunch of people willfully seeking their own salvation? And then the question becomes, well, if so, or even in order to answer that question, what do we mean? What does salvation include? Right? Because to talk. To use the term salvific is that's a 20th century term, I think. And I think it's a Protestant term. There's Protestantism going on, but it's 16th century Protestantism. And the concept of salvation is inexhaustible in this era's mind. It's not and you don't mean this, I don't think, anyway, but it's not a God declares you righteous, done deal. Okay.
Right.
Salvation is cosmic. Right. So if my earlier argument is that Hamlet from earlier sessions, that Hamlet is under the weight of the entire cosmos, political order, social order, moral order, religious order, psychological order, all of that is crashing and burning. OK, then is what Hamlet's about, all of those things being restored and everybody their own way willfully seeking their salvation. Right. And if that's the case, then Gertrude drinking the cup, you have to ask one proposal I would make to anybody who wants to take this journey is, is Gertrude trying to be saved from what, and does it work? Right.
Mm-hmm. And right, exactly.
Trying to be saved from what, and does it work? Is Hamlet, and what's included in this concept of salvation? Because the main point I'm getting at in all of what I'm thinking about out loud at your expense is salvation is a big concept to these people.
Yeah.
And it's not just a judicial decision by God in the spiritual dimension, right? It's total. And so then,
it's not just a funeral scene question either.
It's not.
Right.
That drives the question home. Right. Mm. But if all you think about when you think about salvation is what happens after death, then you're stuck with Hamlet's to be or not to be speech and the front of the gravity returns. But no, it's okay. If I look after death, what does that tell me about now? What does that tell me about politics? And what does that tell me about, does it matter that the kingdom of heaven is coming or is that we can go to, you know, so it's a mirror. It's like, it holds a mirror up to nature. Like, you know, maybe heaven is the ultimate art and it's the ultimate mirror being held up to the human soul and to human society. Because if I were to, this is again, thinking of what both of you said earlier, if I were to summarize what's driven home to me about the moral of the story, which I don't look for, but you know, if I were to do it, I would say that Hamlet is saying to us, be serious.
Mm.
And with a large exclamation point, and not in the sense of sober serious, but in the sense of serious. And the way we,
the be difference serious, being what? The difference being what, Andrew? Tease out that difference.
Well, okay, so
serious and sober.
Made me think that. And then you said something right after I thought that, which I wrote down, which is pay attention. Okay. So being serious means being receptive to reality. Or if you want to put it in a Christian way, seek the logos, right? Wherever it leads you, just see, or even the Socratic way, seek the logos. And you do that by receiving reality into your soul, not fighting with it, not rejecting it, not denying death, not denying the evil within us, the monster within us, the monster within our neighbor, the true beauty within, but accepting all of reality, which is impossible for us. But that's what Hamlet's saying to us, is be serious and don't be serious by thinking only sober thoughts. There's a clown there too, but pay attention.
Yeah. Right?
Pay attention and receive reality. Seek the logos. That's what's hitting me really hard.
Yeah.
I want to add to this because you're sparking my thoughts here. So Aristotle talks about what it means to be a serious person, right? He says, if you're wanting to play an instrument, he uses a cithara. I'll use a piano. If you want to learn to play the piano, you could do a couple of things. You can either dabble or you could be serious, right? If it's the piano, there's not much at stake either way, what? Right? But he says, this is Aristotle's point that he makes, but he says it's different when you're talking about your soul. And he says you should be a serious human, like be serious about being human the same way that you be serious about playing the piano. Right. And then he says, that's why this is his introduction to ethics. He's like, that's why I wrote this book. Right. But for serious people.
Huh.
Right. And I love that. Right. I talk to my students about this all the time when I teach Aristotle's ethics. And like, this is what it means to be a serious person, is to pay attention. And I actually always quote you, Andrew. And I say, like, my godfather and mentor, Andrew Kern, says that the most important thing you can learn in life is how to pay attention. And I think, to your point, this is what Hamlet does. This is why Hamlet is a noble mind, right? It's not because of his noble actions, but because throughout the entire play, he is a serious person. He's serious all the time about being human. He takes seriously, he pays attention, right? And he makes a lot of mistakes. And the reason why his mistakes are so weighty is because he's a serious person, right? Like, I look at the way he treated Ophelia, and because I believe this is a noble mind and a noble man, I'd take very seriously the fact that he treated her so unkindly and doesn't ever repent. But it's because I hold him in such high esteem.
Yeah.
As right. A noble mind, because he's serious about being human, and he really failed in that way. Right. And so I look at that with sober judgment because I take him seriously.
Right.
Right.
If you didn't take him seriously, you wouldn't be so disappointed.
Like with Polonius, right? I'm like, oh, whatever. Like that guy.
Right.
Just,
right.
Like even when he doesn't, because he's not serious about being human. He's serious about only a tiny sliver of his humanity, which is just his job. Right. Because he wants to be prestigious. And so I don't take him that seriously because he's not a serious person in the way we're talking about the word serious. And that is, I think with Hamlet, the actions that he takes fail in some way, many ways in the play. And I think some of the conclusions that he comes to fail in some ways. And yet he's a serious person, and that is noble. That pursuit is noble. But what makes Hamlet, I think, a Christian play versus a classical play is that the pagans tend to put that within Aristotle, I think, plays, and some of the pagans tend to put that within these narrow parameters, right? They don't really take into account the full weight of the human potential to debase and deprave ourselves. And with Hamlet, we have the snake in the grass. We have the serpent in the garden. We have Claudius. And Claudius's actions create so much corruption within all three levels of reality, the universal, the public, and the private, right? And so because of that, then all the other people seeking for their own salvation, as you've used that term with what you just said, Andrew, they're all corrupted by it. I'm going to talk about Harry Potter really briefly, because anytime I have a chance to be an apologist for Harry Potter, I will take it. So one of the things I love about that whole series and why I think it's super important in the contemporary modern literary landscape is that it is a series about the impact of one person's depravity upon the entire society. And the ramifications for Voldemort's depravity are so far reaching. And she's so unflinching in this children's story about examining that, the losses that come to that, the impact on the society that comes from just one person's depravity, right? And a choice to debase and degrade and distort their own soul and then seek for power from there. That's the same thing I think we get in Hamlet. There's such a similarity between Claudius as the villain and how everybody reacts to that, but they don't know that. They think they're reacting to Hamlet's madness, but it's not. It's Claudius's depravity.
Yeah.
That is causing this, but they're looking in the wrong place. It's misdirection, right? And so this is so powerful to me. What you talk about is that it's not so clear cut that if you just like follow the ethical thing, you're going to get the right, you're going to get the right response to that. And you're going to like be able to build this classical edifice of perfection, right? That's not the way it is. And Hamlet is unflinching in its portrayal of that even a noble mind, even a person like Hamlet, who's trying to be a serious person, will in the end be just one of a stage littered with dead bodies in the face of the darkness that the human soul is capable of. And yet, .. here you go, Fortinbras. There is a divinity. There is a divinity that shapes our ends, rough hew them as we will. There's always the potential for harmony and resurrection.
After the queen drinks the poison, Laertes informs Hamlet that he's also been poisoned through a wound that Laertes inflicted. And Hamlet immediately turns on the king. Then venom to thy work. The court calls treason after Hamlet has stabbed Claudius, which, by the way, there's an interesting staging decision here. Everyone calls treason, and yet Hamlet is still able to pick up the poison chalice and kind of force feed it to Claudius. Does this mean that the court willingly stood by while this happened because they know at this point? I think that's a great staging question. Or does Hamlet kind of have to fend off the court with his foil? I think that's the staging decision that needs to be made. I like the idea of the court kind of knowing, you know, the right man is actually about to get the throne very briefly before his life. I like that decision. I would probably direct it that way. And then we get Hamlet's closing lines. And I think we need to close the show with this. He's speaking to Horatio and he's saying goodbye. If thou didst ever hold me in thy heart, absent thee from felicity a while, and in this harsh world draw thy breath in pain to tell my story. The potent poison quite o'ercrows my spirit. I cannot live to hear the news from England, but I do prophesy the election lights on Fortinbras. He has my dying voice, so tell him, with the occurrence more and less, which have solicited, the rest is silence.
You have to read the next line. Now cracks a noble heart. Good night.
Good night, sweet prince.
And flights of angels sing thee to thy rest.
Then comes the introduction to Fortinbras, and Andrew is made happy by the arrival of Fortinbras.
No, I'm happy because the succession takes place.
I know. I'm teasing you. I know. I'm absolutely teasing you. It is about the succession taking place.
It's more than that, though. It's cosmic harmony. You have to have it. I absolutely believe if you ended the play without Fortinbras, you leave open the question of despair because the play is so deep.
Mm.
Well, if I can support that with an almost completely trivial sounding point, Fortinbras comes from Poland. And if my whole cosmological thing is anything, he's representing Copernicus and the Copernican, the Copernican system, which is a new cosmology, right? So he's politically, you know, restoring a dynasty and bringing order. But there's at least a hint there that there's a cosmic harmony as well on a new order.
Andrew, you and I have talked about this off the air. I wonder if it might be something for us to follow up on in this podcast. So we have one more podcast, which is the Q&A podcast. Andrew, you and I have talked off the air, and let's continue to talk off the air about it, about whether or not we want to have a conversation just about the kind of cosmological backdrop behind this play, which I think a lot of people would find interesting, not just because it's a Hamlet question, but also because this moment in European history is just fascinating, crucial, and illuminating to how we live today. So if that ends up happening, we'll announce it on the Q&A podcast, which we're going to record soon. But for now, I want to thank everyone for tuning in to these five acts of Hamlet. They've been absolutely delightful and delicious. And I'm grateful, Heidi and Andrew, that you guys were able to join me for this.
Honor. Thank you.
It's been an honor.
With that, we want to ask you, listeners, please go to the Close Reads Facebook page and send us your questions about Hamlet. We would love to field them during the Q&A session. We thank you for joining us. We thank you for being such loyal patrons and supporters of the podcast. And we continue to wish you happy reading. Die düster Begründen auf Sinnen Gliegerlott hat verschmeckte, wo Elsinores Lott.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.